From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, the life of the Godfather of Soul. Bruce Tucker collaborated with James Brown on his autobiography. Tucker joins us to update the James Brown story. Also today, comic Stephen Wright on his surrealistic observations and his catatonic delivery. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the debut album from the New York Composers Orchestra. And Maureen Corrigan reviews John McPhee's latest book about the U.S. Merchant Marine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. Coast Guard boarded and took control of an Iraqi-flagged freighter in the Gulf of Oman today. While hundreds of ships have been stopped, Pentagon officials say this is the first seizure since the international embargo of Iraqi exports and imports began a month ago. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
No shots were fired, and there was little resistance as Coast Guardsmen boarded and took the helm of the Iraqi cargo ship Zenubia. The freighter, bound for Iraq with a load of Sri Lankan tea, refused to heed radio calls from a U.S.-guided missile destroyer, and it was stopped and boarded. Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams says it was seized because tea does not fall under the category of medical supplies. The Defense Department says 550 vessels have been challenged by radio and 20 have been boarded. Most are allowed to proceed when it's determined they're empty or bound for destinations other than Iraq. This is only the second Iraqi-flagged vessel to be stopped. An Iraqi tanker was boarded in the Red Sea on Friday. After it was discovered to be empty, it was sent on its way. The U.S. also fired warning shots across the bows of two Iraqi tankers that refused to stop a few weeks ago. While commercial shippers say it's impossible to get through the military net formed by the U.S. and allied naval forces, there are reports that food is being flown into Iraq. The White House says these air leaks do not warrant military interception. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
Tons of food and medical supplies were airlifted to Jordan today, but officials say that conditions for refugees from Kuwait and Iraq continued to deteriorate. A huge Soviet-made cargo plane, chartered by the United Nations, brought in at least 100 tons of Dutch goods to help the refugees. The plane was expected to be used to ferry out refugees on its return trip. A British charter airplane also landed in Amman with tons of food and medical supplies. The remains of former Chilean President Salvador Allende were given a ceremonial reburial today, 17 years after his death in a military overthrow. It was also the 20th anniversary of the election victory that made Allende the first democratically elected Marxist to become a head of state. As David Wilner reports from Santiago, the reburial had the full support of Chile's new civilian government.
There were tears and shouts of viva as the motorcade bearing Allende's remains passed thousands of his supporters lining the streets of Santiago. For Allende's family, this was the proper burial the former president was denied after he died during the 1973 bombing attack on the presidential palace. For Chilean President Patricio Elwin, who spoke at Allende's graveside, it was a chance to heal old wounds. Elwin, who's a center-right Christian Democrat, once supported Allende's overthrow. But for General Augusto Pinochet, who toppled Allende and then seized power for 16 years, the ceremony was an affront. Next week, the general, who still commands the army, will celebrate the 17th anniversary of his rise to power. For National Public Radio, I'm David Walna in Santiago.
The Dow Industrials lost just 1 point today to close at 2,613.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before James Brown went to prison almost 2 years ago, he wrote an autobiography. My guest Bruce Tucker is the person who convinced Brown to tell the story of his life and collaborated with Brown on writing the book. Tucker is a white writer. He was teaching a course at Fisk University on the autobiographies of black musicians when he realized there was a big gap. James Brown hadn't written a book. James Brown, The Godfather of Soul, was published in 1986, the same year Brown had his first top 10 pop single since the late 60s. James Brown's imprisonment gave living in America an ironic twist, a subject that's addressed in the epilogue of the new edition of Godfather of Soul. Bruce Tucker has kept in touch with Brown during his imprisonment. Brown is now in a work release program.
Well, at the moment, he's working in a community action center in Aiken, South Carolina, having served 18 months of a 6-year sentence. There's a possibility that he could get out very soon on extended work release, but at the moment, I don't think he wants extended work release because it's fraught with dangers for him.
What kind of dangers?
Well, you know, when you're in that situation, all you have to do is make one tiny mistake, and then you're back in jail for the rest of the sentence.
And he's afraid he'd slip up?
Well, all you have to do, for example, is be late for an appointment, and he's certainly capable of that. But more sinisterly, I think, if there was someone who wanted him to mess up, it could be easily arranged.
What were the charges against him in the first place?
Well, what he was convicted of was refusing to stop for a police officer and aggravated assault. He received a 5.5-year sentence for refusing to stop for a police officer. So far as I know, that's the longest sentence in American history for what's essentially a traffic violation.
Oh, you got a traffic violation, but the cops are in hot pursuit.
Yes.
And he was fleeing from them across state lines, I think, and they fired, what, about 23 shots at him?
Yes, into the cab of the pickup truck that he was driving. So, believing himself to be in great danger, he put the truck in reverse. Two officers had to jump out of the way, and that was the basis of the aggravated assault charge. As he said, I aggravated them and they assaulted me.
Let's describe what the chase was about in the first place.
Well, in his office building where he maintains his business offices, there was an insurance seminar going on in the adjacent office, and they were coming over from the insurance seminar and using his bathroom, and he objected to it, and he walked into the insurance seminar, and he was carrying a shotgun that, so far as I know, was not even loaded and possibly not even functional. And he rambled a little bit about them using his property and so forth. And then he left, and someone called the police. And when he heard the police coming after him, he drove across the Savannah River into South Carolina, going home, no doubt. And then the South Carolina police chased him back across the river, and he was eventually apprehended in Augusta on the Georgia side.
I don't understand. Maybe you have a sense from talking to James Brown why someone of his stature would be so afraid of being stopped by the police that he would flee from them even while he was being shot at by the police. I mean, he's James Brown.
Well, he had been stopped and arrested and taken into custody 4 or 5 times in the preceding year before this last incident, and I think he wanted no more of it.
He was also high on PCP. There was a drug test done on him. There was PCP in his system.
Well, that's the story. I think it's important to remember that he was neither tried nor convicted for a drug offense.
Why wasn't he tried? I mean, if in fact the test was done and it showed PCP in his system, how come there weren't any official drug charges brought up?
Well, I suppose the authorities didn't feel that they could make the case.
Oh. Do you think the sentence was too harsh?
Yes, I think it's unquestionably too harsh. I don't think, of course, that artists or any other prominent person should be socially exempt from punishment like the rest of us. But on the other hand, even if you think he belonged in jail, and I certainly don't, 18 months is enough. Enough is enough. It's time for him to get out. He's clearly being punished for being James Brown.
My guest is Bruce Tucker, and he wrote an autobiography with James Brown that's just been reissued. And you describe James Brown as the most important living American musician. Let me ask you to describe what makes him that important.
Well, I think unquestionably he's the most influential. James Brown's music is everywhere now in the landscape of contemporary music. It underlies rap, dance pop, African world beat, jazz, funk, fusion. You hear it in the music of everyone from Prince to Herbie Hancock to Wah's Not Wah's to the Talking Heads. There's hardly a popular musician who hasn't been influenced by James Brown. And, of course, he's heard most clearly in rap, where his songs and his voice and so forth are either sampled over and over again, or he's explicitly mentioned as the source of inspiration. So yes, I think he is the most important living American musician. And the music for which he should be known is the funk. He's called the Godfather of Soul, which is slightly misleading because his enduring contribution to American music is funk, the records he made in the mid-60s through the early 70s.
Well, let's listen to the first hit that he had, and this is from 1956. The record was Please, Please, Please. Would you like to say something about this?
Well, this is James's first record. He recorded a demo of it in a Macon radio station, and it eventually got to King Records in Cincinnati. And he went up there, and the Famous Flames went with him, and they cut it. And it was a hit. It was a big hit.
Please, 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 please.
James Brown, Please, 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 recorded in 1956, and my guest Bruce Tucker wrote James Brown's autobiography with him, and it's just been republished. What do you think was different from this record by other music that was on the charts at the time?
Well, it's not really so different. I mean, that was the heyday of doo-wop and a lot and Southern gospel and the beginnings, the first stirrings of soul. But I think what's distinctive about it is James's voice. It's one of the most distinctive voices in American singing, as distinctive as that of Louis Armstrong, it seems to me, and is instantly recognizable.
And this is before he started shout singing.
Yes.
James Brown actually started to sing in jail, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Actually, he had done a few amateur shows and things like that before he was sent to jail. That is the first time when he was 15 years old, and when he emerged from jail 3 years later, he formed a gospel group, which eventually evolved into an R&B group and became the Famous Flames.
Fill us in a little bit about his background. He came from a really poor background.
Yes, he was born out in the woods in South Carolina and moved into Augusta, Georgia, which was a wide-open serviceman's town at that time in the late 30s, early 40s. Lived in a brothel with an aunt named Honey Washington. They sold moonshine whiskey in addition to the other activities that went on in that house. Eventually, the house was closed down by the police. James then, as a pre-teenager, I guess you would say, began getting into trouble here and there. He broke into some unlocked cars to steal some clothes, got caught, and was sentenced to 8 to 16 years in prison for breaking into unlocked cars. Another extremely harsh sentence. He served only 3 of those years. He wrote a letter to the parole board saying that he wanted to get out and sing gospel for the Lord. He was known as Music Box in prison because of his singing. He got out, formed the group, and then about 6 years later, there came Please, 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 and then after that, he conquered the Apollo Theater in New York and went on from there to become the superstar that he remains.
We mentioned the Apollo Theater. Why don't we listen to something from his 1962 Live at the Apollo album? And James Brown, I mean, has been a spectacular performer. And this will give some sense of the more like show business aspect
of
his performances.
Yes, and the excitement of him as a live performer in front of the toughest audience in the world, the Apollo Theater audience.
And what we're hearing is James Brown getting introduced.
Yes.
So now listen, gentlemen, it is start time. Are you ready for start time? Thank you, and thank you very kindly. It is indeed a great pleasure to present to you at this particular time, national and international known as the hardest working man in show business, man that's saying, I'll go crazy. Bewildered. $1 million seller, lost someone. The very latest release, Night Train. Let's everybody shout and shimmy. Mr. Dynamite, the amazing Mr. Please Please himself, the star of the show, James Brown and the Famous Flame.
Well, I don't really want to say anything after that.
Not much to say.
No. Did he ever travel with his own announcer?
Oh, yes. In fact, quite well known, a man named Danny Ray, who does the announcing. I'm not sure that was Danny there. I think that was a man named Fats Gonder, who is now dead. But yes, he travels with a man named Danny Ray, who's responsible for the capes and so forth.
Is this a James Brown innovation to have your own announcer traveling with you to introduce you?
Well, I think the innovation is for a performer to put together an entire review like that with an orchestra and so forth, and to take it around from city to city and to hold it together for more than 30 years. Some of America's greatest musicians have come to grief when they tried to put together what's in essence a big band, if you will, and try to make it work. But James was always able to do that. Yes, he was. That is an innovation in a kind of show business way, and with the emphasis on business.
Would you describe James Brown's cape routine and how he created it?
Well, it comes at the end of the performance. Now he just simply more or less alludes to it in performance. But back when he was doing the days of Live at the Apollo and so forth, he would do a sort of collapse and resurrection routine at the end of the performance, because he would come out and knock himself out on stage for several hours dancing, singing, and so forth, and he was understandably exhausted. Of course, there's a good deal of histrionics involved, but he is genuinely exhausted. And in the beginning, one of the Famous Flames, the singers, would approach him, and they would put a raincoat around his shoulders and start to lead him off, and then he would shake it off like a boxer and come back out on the stage and go through the whole thing again and until finally he would disappear. And then when the crowd had yelled long enough, he would appear again on stage dressed in a brand new suit and with a suitcase ready to hitchhike to the next town on the on the agenda. But after a while, as Bobby Bird, one of the Famous Flames, told me, they started to lose their raincoats, so they decided to get a cape. Nobody wanted to volunteer their raincoat anymore. But he got the idea of using the cape, interestingly enough, from watching the famous wrestler of the 1950s, Gorgeous George, who used a cape and behaved in a similar fashion in the wrestling ring.
What about James Brown's hairdos? He used to have this really large process, and then in the late 60s got an afro, but his hair has always been really important part of his style.
Yes, and getting that sort of modified afro in the 60s represented a painful concession for him, because he's always been very proud of his hair. In fact, if you look at the pictures in the book and you see the way in which his hair has evolved over the years, you get a kind of brief synopsis of cultural history right there.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about James Brown. And my guest is Bruce Tucker, who wrote James Brown's autobiography with Brown, and it's just been republished. It's called James Brown, the Godfather of Soul. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bruce Tucker, who wrote with James Brown the book James Brown, the Godfather of Soul. And as you say, James Brown is really the godfather of funk. And the turning point for him in terms of starting to play funk was his 1965 record, Papa's Got a Brand New Bag. What was different about this record, and what did James Brown have to tell you about it?
Well, at this point, he didn't have to tell me anything about it, because it's been so influential. It's something that we now can hear very easily. But the difference in funk is that, for one thing, in jazz, for example, the emphasis falls on the first and the third beats in the measure, and in rock and roll on the second and the fourth, the famous backbeat. Whereas in funk, all of the rhythmic emphasis is on the one, is on that first downbeat at the beginning of a measure, and it really drives the music forward. You can hear it in this song in Embryo, and then in later work, quite clearly. And the other thing is the polyrhythmic complexity, which is what James is known for. The other thing I think worth noting about this record is the date, 1965. If you recall, soul of both the shouting and the churchy varieties didn't peak until 67 or 68, and then more or less ended with the death of Dr. King. But in 1965, James was already leaving soul behind for funk. I mean, it's an amazingly revolutionary record if you put it in historical perspective like that.
I really like something he said to you about this record. He said that he discovered his strength wasn't in the horns, it was in the rhythm. He said he was hearing everything, even the guitars, like they were drums.
Exactly, yes, and I think that is the key to funk and the key to James Brown. Everything is used percussively, the voices, the guitars, the drums. He carried two and sometimes three drummers during this period on the road. Yes, everything is used percussively. I think one of the difficulties in making the case for musicians like James Brown for their importance is that Western music theory downgrades things that aren't important in European classical music, such as rhythm. And so there's no means of adequately notating it or so forth, or appreciating it. And so we're, in a sense, trained not to hear it, but it's there. And that's James's great, great achievement.
This is James Brown, 1965. That's James Brown, and my guest Bruce Tucker worked with James Brown on his autobiography, James Brown, the Godfather of Soul. James Brown is kind of a riddle to me politically. I mean, he had that really big and really influential record, Say It Loud and Black and I'm Proud, in 1968. He had supported H. Rapp Brown. At the same time, though, he supported Richard Nixon and played at Richard Nixon's inaugural. Can you help reconcile those two different political parts of James Brown?
Well, I think that it's difficult to reconcile the parts of James Brown, because I think James Brown is deeply ambivalent about a great many things, and I think it shows up in precisely those kinds of oppositions that you set up. He gave money to the H. Rapp Brown Defense Fund. He also bought a lifetime membership in the NAACP. He was a great admirer of Dr. Martin Luther King, and he's very close to Reverend Al Sharpton. He made a record that was almost contemporaneous with Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, called America Is My Home, for which he took a great deal of heat from a great many people. So I think that there's a deep contradiction in him, and I think it's difficult to reconcile. I think it's difficult for him to reconcile, because this country has greatly rewarded him and viciously punished him throughout his life, beginning from the time he was a child and right up to the present. So it's difficult to reconcile. The song "Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud," which appeared in '68, of course, cost him his crossover audience. People became afraid to come to his concerts and so forth. And if you listen to the song, of course, what you immediately notice is that it's almost a children's song. There's a children's chorus on there singing the refrain.
Well, let's do what you just suggested a moment ago and listen to his 1968 record, Say It Loud.
You
James Brown recorded in 1968. One of the things James Brown talks about in the autobiography is how he hated disco and how he thinks he was really hurt by it.
Yes, unquestionably. In fact, he all but retired in the late 70s. All of these revolutionary records, you can hear in Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, in addition to being an anthem of black pride, it's also a really stripped-down, bare-bones, propulsive funk record, as funky as any record he ever made. All of that music that he made then in the late 60s and early 70s was suddenly obscured by disco. And it depressed him, and he all but retired from performing in this country. He still performed in Europe and Japan and so forth, but he semi-retired. He encountered a lot of personal problems at that time also. His second wife left him. The son, who was the apple of his eye, was killed in an automobile accident in upstate New York. And he retired for several years, in effect.
Did rap create a comeback for James Brown?
Well, actually... James's comeback in rap more or less coincided. I think what brought him back, and I think he would be the first to say this, is his appearance in the Blues Brothers, the motion picture, mm-hmm. in 1980, and then subsequently in one of the Rocky pictures in which Living in America was included. But yes, rap has certainly brought him back. I think another thing that's been happening, and it's absolutely astonishing, is the critical reevaluation that has gone on of James Brown in the last 5 years. We've been talking today about how important he is as a musician. This is not merely my opinion. I think you would find that this is now the consensus among popular music critics, and it's an absolutely astonishing turnaround, because as recently as 1980 or the early 80s, the critics were relatively indifferent to him. But I think that that's explicable, because most people who write about popular music are middle-aged white men who don't dance.
Do you dance?
Yes, but I'm still a middle-aged white man.
When was the last time you spoke to James Brown?
About 2 weeks ago. I spoke to him by phone in the at the Community Action Center where he works.
And what was his mood?
I would have to say that he sounded a bit more downhearted than I have heard him in a long time. He's really indomitable. I think that's been true of him throughout his life and career. But I think he's been in there long enough, and I think he thinks that as well.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
My guest has been Bruce Tucker, and he worked with James Brown on writing Brown's autobiography, The Godfather of Soul, which has recently come out in revised paperback edition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
All you copycats out there! Get off of my tip, because I'm James Brown with the force.
Full force.
Ain't taking no lip.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's music by composer and saxophonist Marty Ehrlich, performed by the New York Composers Orchestra. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the orchestra's first album. Comic Stephen Wright says his job is noticing the insanities of life. Wright then points out those insanities to his audiences with a very downbeat delivery. Coming up, Stephen Wright tells us about the insanities of his life. And writer John McPhee has examined everything from how oranges are grown and shipped to the basketball career of Senator Bill Bradley. Coming up, critic Maureen Carrigan examines McPhee's latest book about the U.S. Merchant Marine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The White House says it will ask Congress to write off Egypt's $7 billion military aid debt. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more on the story.
A White House spokesman, Marlon Fitzwater, says the debt forgiveness proposal is a symbol of appreciation for Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak's support for the U.S. in the standoff against Iraq.
By this decision, the president is also recognizing the unique strategic contribution of Egypt to the pursuit of peace and security in the Middle East, a role that Egypt has played with courage, determination, and consistency.
The debt write-off does not affect another $6 billion in food and development aid Egypt has received from the U.S. Thus far, lawmakers have agreed with the president's proposal. However, some are concerned that other U.S. allies will seek similar arrangements, and Israeli sources say their government will request that the U.S. forgive Israel's $4.5 billion military aid debt. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The leader of the country's largest black church group has criticized the U.S. troop buildup in the Persian Gulf. The Reverend T.J. Jemison, president of the National Baptist Convention, says the crisis is all over oil, and in his words, fine young men and women are in jeopardy over oil in the Persian Gulf. The convention is to vote this week on a resolution attacking the troop deployment that followed Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. Israel has turned down an invitation from Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze to attend an international conference on the Gulf crisis and the Arab-Israeli conflict. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir rejected the idea of an international peace conference. Soviet Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze had broached the idea earlier today and said that if Israel attended, the Soviet Union would consider reestablishing full diplomatic relations with Israel, a step Israel has long wanted. But Israeli officials say the only way to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict is with bilateral relations and give, as an example, the peace treaty with Egypt. Shamir also said that the Palestinian problem will be easier to solve once the Gulf crisis is over, especially now that the PLO has shown it is not a partner for negotiations, he said. Meanwhile, Israeli Foreign Minister David Levy is in the U.S. for his first meeting with U.S. Secretary of State James Baker tomorrow. They will discuss the Gulf crisis and the Palestinian issue. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
And the U.S. Navy stopped an Iraqi ship in the Persian Gulf today, and officials say that the ship was carrying tea to Iraq in violation of the economic embargo against that country. It was the first reported seizure by U.S. military forces of an Iraqi ship since the invasion of Kuwait just over a month ago. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down a point to close at 2,613.37, volume 93 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later in the show, comedian Stephen Wright. But first, if you're a young jazz composer who writes music for big band, there are three things you can do. You can file your charts away in a drawer somewhere. You can chase after one of the few established big band leaders and try to persuade them to read through your stuff. Or you can assemble your own orchestra. That's what Robin Holcomb and Wayne Horvitz did when they founded the New York Composers Orchestra 4 years ago. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews their debut album.
That's an excerpt from Pliant Plaint by saxophonist Marty Ehrlich. He's one of four composers represented on the debut album by the New York Composers Orchestra, which is a 15-piece band at full strength. Their debut album is on the New World label. Ehrlich, by the way, is the only one of the four composers who lives in New York. Pianists Robin Holcomb and Wayne Horvitz currently reside in Seattle, and saxophonist Doug Weiselman lives in San Francisco. Weiselman contributed two pieces to the album, including the Montana section, inspired by the sound of wind blowing through the Montana hills.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the pieces on this album, the Montana section is the one furthest removed from standard big band practices. Robin Holcomb's suite, Nightbirds, Open 24 Hours, draws on the arranging styles of masters like Carla Bley and Gil Evans, but Holcomb's writing has a dramatic quality all her own. Wayne Horvitz wrote the most music for the orchestra's album, and to my ears, he's the band's most consistently interesting writer. He has a great ear for instrumental color, and a knack for cramming a lot of action into a piece without overdoing it. Here's the complete middle section of his three-part suite, The House That Brings a Smile. Wayne Horvitz's The House That Brings a Smile takes its title from a tune by the rock band The Band. His writing often acknowledges the pop music he grew up with. Horvitz's composition, Prodigal Son Revisited, was inspired by the Rolling Stones cover of bluesman Robert Wilkins' tune, Prodigal Son.
Well, poor boy, too far as bread, started down the road, started down the road. All he had started down the road. Going out in this world, well, God only knows. And that'll be the way to get along.
But by the time Horvitz is through with it, it sounds more like one of Charles Mingus's gospel stomps. The high quality of this music is especially impressive, considering the limited opportunities these composers have to write for big bands, and for most of these musicians to play in them. Alto saxophonist Cleve Guyton has put in several years with Lionel Hampton's orchestra, and trombonist Art Barron was one of the last musicians hired by Duke Ellington. Still, most of the players, including trombonist Ray Anderson, bassist Lindsay Horner, and drummer Bobby Previtt, usually work in small groups. But this music's so sharp, you'd think these folks played in big bands all the time.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed the debut of the New York Composers Orchestra on the New World Records. This is Fresh Air. Stephen Wright isn't the kind of comic you'd expect to be the life of the party. He's too cerebral and downbeat, but this low-key style gets big laughs. Wright's stand-up career took off after an appearance in 1982 on The Johnny Carson Show. Wright does a lot of television and tours college campuses. He played the suburban dentist in the movie Desperately Seeking Susan. Last year, he co-wrote and starred in a short film called The Appointments of Dennis Jennings. It won an Academy Award. Wright has a new comedy special airing this month on HBO.
Bought some land. It was kind of cheap. It was on somebody else's property. Bought an ant farm. I don't know where I'm going to get tracked. Is that small? I bought a cordless extension cord. It's like you don't even know. Yesterday I bought a decaffeinated coffee table. You can't even tell by looking at it.
Your HBO special is almost an hour long. Is that a really long amount of time for stand-up? In terms of putting it together.
Oh yeah, it took a lot of years to get that amount of time that worked. Because for every three jokes I write, only about one out of three is good enough to stay in the act. And they're all about 10 seconds long.
Yeah, so, that's the thing. Like, you don't tell long stories or anything.
No, it did. It took a long time.
Have you ever wished that you did things that went on a longer time than 10 seconds, so it would be easier to put together an hour?
Yes, I've wished that. And I've tried it sometimes, but it doesn't seem to work. For me, I've gotten so used to doing it this way that I did it this way kind of by accident. I realized after a few years I was doing it like this, I realized the reason I did it like that was I didn't want to be standing there without the audience laughing.
This is where you get a laugh every 10 seconds.
Yeah, because it would made me just too nervous to tell a long setup. You know, it was just that silence was too uncomfortable.
So it sounds like even on stage you're pretty self-conscious?
Yeah, it's just, well, it's so extreme. It's a weird thing to do, to talk to that many people. So have one, for one guy to be talking to that many people, I think it's nerve-wracking. Besides trying, not only are you talking to them, you're trying to make them laugh for an hour.
Were you in a complete panic the first few times you did this?
Oh, yes. It was horrible. It was unbelievable. I mean, there's still an anxiety there, but I'm as relaxed. I'm pretty relaxed. It's not going to get any more relaxed than I am now. But in the first times, it was just horrifying.
In 1989, you got an Academy Award for a short you co-wrote and starred in called The Appointments of Dennis Jennings, about a neurotic guy and his visit to his shrink. Did you enjoy making yourself into a character?
I think it was this character on stage, you know? It's like me exaggerated, and I just took him off the stage and put him into the movie. That's how I see it. I really made the character when I was making him for stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where he was really made. It was fun putting that guy into situations, you know, Now I stand up is like I'm describing things to the audience that happened, and in the film you just show it to the audience rather than describing it through a microphone.
So do you always go back like the character does and check to see if you lock the windows and turn the oven off?
I do some of that in real life.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people do that.
Count me in, unfortunately.
What do you do it with?
Well, did I really lock the door? Did I really turn off the fan? Did I really close the windows? Did I really turn off the stove? Is the toaster oven off?
Do you go back, though?
I go back.
Do you have a limit on how many times you'll go back?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I've thought of making a list and keeping it on the door so I could check it off and I could just leave feeling really secure, saying, like, hey, I checked it all off. I don't have to think about this again. But for some reason, I've never made that list. So.
Yeah, but then you could get out on the street and go, oh, did I look at the list?
That's right. Oh. Well, you know what's frightening? When you've totally forgotten that you've done something, yet you have. You know, like when you just shut the window and you walk into the next room and say, gosh, did I shut that window?
Yes. I know, it's nuts.
Do you wonder, like, am I that lost in thought?
Do I live in New York? Yes, I live in New York.
Do I remember getting home tonight?
I admire people who don't have that.
Yeah, me too.
It's off. What do you mean? I know I shut it off. Let's go. You know, but I mean, maybe you shut it off yesterday and you're just thinking about yesterday.
Mm. When you have a really big gig coming up,
yes.
What kinds of things do you worry about? Do you worry about getting sick right before?
No, but now you...
Oh, I gave you something to worry about.
I'm
the right person to talk to for that.
No, that never enters my mind. I don't think I've ever missed a show because I was sick.
So what do you worry about that's going to go wrong and screw things up?
I mainly worry about if I can pace the show correctly and I can remember the entire act. That's the main concern. Because there's so much of it that I just want to be able to remember it all.
Do you ever forget?
Oh, yeah, every night.
So what do you do?
I go over and get some water, I walk around, or I look up at the ceiling, you know, and I act a little strange, and they think that I'm just, they're not sure if I really forgot or I'm acting like I forgot.
Well, do you have it written down somewhere that you can check?
No. No.
So say it doesn't come back to you.
Well, it does. See, if I 2 or 3 seconds, 5 seconds, that's a lot of silence
on
stage.
On the radio, too.
But it usually comes to me.
I've read that you are afraid of planes, or were afraid of planes. Are you still?
Yeah, I don't particularly like it. When I go on a tour, I go on by bus. One of those tour buses, like a band.
Mm-hmm.
Except it's just me way in the back.
Well, you can stretch out and be comfortable.
Just sitting there, like cleaning my fingernails with a matchbook, waiting for the next city.
So you have a bus driver and everything?
Yeah, he's way, way, way in the front. I can take a mini. I take a mini bike from the back to the front. How much more? 200 more miles. Thanks, Eddie. And the routing is important. You know, you don't want to do like Seattle, Miami, Boston, San Diego on a bus, because that would a four city 5 month tour. So, but it's better. I like it.
Your character in the movie that you co-wrote, you know, it's about him and his shrink. Have you seen or do you see a psychologist?
I did when I was little. In case people don't know, the movie was about a guy who kills his own psychiatrist. I like telling that what it's about because that cracks me up. I saw a psychiatrist when I was little, when I was 7, 8, and 9. I went all the time. I was nervous about going into double digits because I knew most people die when they're in double digits. So the closer I got to it, I was just freaking out. That was mainly why I was going.
Was this at the suggestion of parents or a teacher?
To go?
Yeah.
Yes, both.
Were they really worried about you?
It was a group thing. It was a rally outside my house.
So
we'll contribute it.
Did you get along with the therapist?
Yeah, I did. He was a nice guy.
And did you lose your fear of dying when you turned into double digits?
No. I made the whole thing up. But I did see one when I was a kid, but it wasn't for that reason.
Do you want to say what the reason was?
No, it was just scared. I was just scared. You know?
Of everything?
Just nervous. Extremely introverted.
Well, it's not hard for me to believe that you were nervous and introverted.
No, it's still... You should have seen me then.
When you were a nervous and introverted kid, did well-meaning people come up to you and say, Oh, what's the matter? Why don't you give us a smile?
Oh, people still do that to me.
Doesn't it drive you crazy?
Yes.
I think it's the most insensitive thing
to
do.
It's nuts. It's nuts.
What, would you have comebacks?
For no
or?
Reason. Yeah. No, I never could think. To this day, I don't know what to say to them. I mean, just because you're not smiling doesn't mean it's, everything's horrible. It means that you're not an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
Even now, hey, Steve, cheer up. You know, I might have been thinking about something. I mean, everything's not funny, obviously.
So do you say anything now when someone says that to you?
No, I don't. I give them a little smile. I know it's giving in, but it makes... but
you're compromising.
It's giving in, but it's...
You're just, selling out.
I'm selling out by smiling. That's hilarious. I just smile so they won't ask me anything else. Because if I get into a discussion, it's longer than just smiling.
Right. Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It was nice talking to you.
Comedian Stephen Wright. His new comedy special premieres September 8th on HBO. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today, the first of a two-part series on the controversy surrounding the National Endowment for the Arts and attempts to restrict what kinds of projects the NEA can give money to. Ina Jaffe has prepared the series. Also, today we talk with two writers about democracy in the Arab world. In light of the Persian Gulf crisis, we ask, why is there so little of it? And we hear some very different answers from David Price-Jones, a British author, writer of The Closed Circle, a book that he calls An Interpretation of the Arabs, and Tamam Al-Barazi, an Arab journalist who calls himself a pan-Arabist, Washington bureau chief of a pan-Arab magazine.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. John McPhee has written about landscapes from Alaska to the New Jersey Pine Barrens. But in his new book, McPhee Goes to Sea with the U.S. Merchant Marine. They're not a branch of the military, but an enterprise of competing companies sailing under the American flag, an enterprise that is now struggling to stay vital. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Looking for a Ship.
The first song I ever remember singing was, "We're going to sink the Bismarck to the bottom of the sea." My father taught it to me. He was in the Merchant Marine before World War II, and then the Navy. I grew up hearing about the great sea battles of Leyte Gulf and Midway, and about how he just missed being blown to smithereens on Merchant Marine tankers sailing between Philadelphia and Galveston. People often don't believe me when I pass on these war stories about German U-boats attacking merchant ships all along the eastern seaboard. But now I have John McPhee's new book to back me up. In Looking for a Ship, McPhee quotes one old salt who recalls that, "In New York Harbor, the Germans were waiting for you at the sea buoy. The front was at the sea buoy." During World War II, the percentage of deaths in the Merchant Marine was higher than in the Army or Navy. Something like 800 ships went down and over 6,000 sailors died. Yet most people, then and now, have never understood what the Merchant Marine is or does. Looking for a Ship isn't a history of the Merchant Marine, although it's filled with background information. Instead, it's a hypnotic account of McPhee's voyage aboard one of the last American merchant ships, the SS Stella Likes. McPhee teams up with Andy Chase, a 32-year-old second mate who's looking for a ship that needs a licensed hand. Chase has been out of work for 10.5 months. When he finds a vacancy, he has to gamble that his seniority will boost him ahead of other unemployed sailors. Chase and McPhee get lucky. The Stella Likes takes them on a 42-day dream run through the Panama Canal and down the Pacific coast of South America. They sail beside the snowy Andes, and on clear nights, the purple planet of Venus lights a path on the water. They see rainbows round the moon. They stop at romantic-sounding ports, Cartagena, Balboa, just long enough to transfer their unromantic freight, 18,000 pounds of cellophane, over 1 million pounds of coffee, and 6,480 toilet pedestals. The average age of the skeleton crew of the Stella Likes is 51, yet these sailors work 18-hour days and defend their ship against modern pirates and violent ocean storms. McPhee praises them as a special breed of men who don't fit in, and that description especially fits their captain. Paul McHenry Washburn is like a character out of a boy's adventure novel. Washburn, a descendant of Chief Justice John Marshall, ran away from home to join the circus and then the merchant marine. He's a contented loner who reads biographies of Columbus and prefers talking to his ship instead of to other people. McPhee ends his book with a picture of the Stella Likes and the merchant marine dead in the water. No new American merchant ships are being built, and the jobs are so scarce that officers now work as deckhands. Looking for a ship is intended as a sea dirge for the merchant marine. But somehow, McPhee's sad, spellbinding story about this ghost navy with its strange cargo makes me want to ship out tomorrow.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed John McPhee's new book, Looking for a Ship. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with help from Joan Tuohy and Sue Spolin. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist James Traub tells us how the WedTech company went from a free enterprise dream story to one of the scandals of the Reagan era. Also, British music critic Charles Shar Murray on the legacy of Jimi Hendrix. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
It's 8 o'clock on 91 FM. Good evening, my name is Melinda Whiting, and our engineer tonight is Dan Laughlin. Coming up at 9 o'clock tonight on Evening Classics, we'll have another 91 FM community concert encore broadcast. This concert tonight, recorded in June of 1988.